What's going on, everybody? Welcome to a very special edition of Clack Radio Speakers. I am one of your hosts, Doc. You can follow me on Twitter at Doc_Beats, S not a Z. We are joined this week by a very special guest. Actually, you know, we have two sort of special guests in a way. We've got Armand, but in a whole different situation. Armand is out in Florida doing life things. We've got him on cell phone right now. Armand, say hello to everybody.
What's going on, y'all? I am in the magical world of Orlando, Florida, and I'm in the place where dreams come true, and I'm with my kids. So, but, you know, Clack Radio Speakers is for the people. So, you know, in the midst of trying to get my kids fed and squared away and all that stuff, I had to do what I had to do for the people. So that's what it is.
For the people is the sort of unofficial motto for Clack Radio Speakers. So the other, the real special guest this week is Wendy Day, founder of Rap Coalition. You can follow her on Twitter at Rap Coalition, all one word. Wendy, how you doing?
I'm awesome. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
That's fantastic. I love that kind of enthusiasm. As always, you can follow us. You know, the official Twitter handle for the show is at CRS Podcast, all one word. You can check the website, clackradiospeakers.com, for past episodes. You can subscribe in iTunes, rate and review us, because as always with everything on iTunes, the more reviews we get, and the higher ratings we get, the more people can hear our stuff. Additionally, I'm trying to think, facebook.com/clackradiospeakers. And of course, on The Pulse Radio every Sunday night, 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Armand, I don't know what Armand's going to be doing this week because we're talking to Wendy, but you know, Armand will play music that is inspired by or related to whatever we talk about on the show. And I'm going to try to keep this brief because Armand's only got a certain amount of time and I don't want to waste Wendy's time. So I guess we're going to get right into it. So Wendy, I think most of the people who listen to the show have at least heard your name. And most of the time when people say Wendy Day, you know, they often hear about the famous No Limit, or even more specifically, really the Cash Money contracts that you had a hand in. Do you want to give people a quick intro to what you've been doing lately?
Sure. You know, I started Rap Coalition in 1992, and I came to it as a fan. And as a fan, I grew weary of hearing about my favorite artists getting stuck into bad contracts. So when I came into the music industry, Doc, I came in because I wanted to help break contracts and help get artists into better situations. And I'm really proud of the fact that I've gotten to play a tremendous role in the careers of a lot of artists in hip-hop that matter, from, you know, the No Limit days, Cash Money, Eminem, David Banner, Twista, Do or Die, MGK. I've gotten to work with some really great artists. But, you know, as the music industry has changed, thanks to the internet, I realized very quickly that you can make a lot of money independently, and as long as you have an investor, you don't really need a record label anymore. Most artists that have some entrepreneurial spirit and some sense of grind can really be their own record label today. So that's the direction that my career has taken since about 2005 until now.
You touched on about three different questions that I wanted to ask you about, so I'm glad I'm on the right track here. We've spent a little bit of time recently on the show really talking about the impact that social media and the internet, and not just hip hop, but really specifically how artists are perceived now, their relationship with fans. You know, so I'm 30 and Armand's in his late 20s. You know, the era that we grew up on, there was a certain mystique with rappers. You know, if you didn't read about it in the source or later, you know, Double XL or something like Blaze or even Rap Pages, you know, if you didn't see them on MTV Jams or on Rap City, then it didn't happen. And now, now artists have this, you know, it's a double-edged sword. They have this, you know, unlimited access. When you talk with artists, what do you tell them about, you know, social media, but even, I mean, almost, you know, Twitter is really what seems to be the most popular usage of that. That sort of direct communication. What do you tell artists about that?
You know, I'm going to even take it a step further and tell you that, you know, when we were coming up, we did get our information from BET and from the source, but we only saw what the artists wanted us to see or what the artists' handlers wanted us to see.
Yeah.
And now with Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all the different ways we have to interact directly with our favorite artists, we really get to see who they are as people, not just as artists. So we see the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know? And with artists, I always coach them to be very careful as to what they use Twitter for, because Twitter just gives you a 140-character glimpse into somebody's life. You can't really get to know somebody thoroughly on Twitter because you don't see every angle of their personality, and you also can't read tone in a text or a tweet. So very often some of what the artist says can be misinterpreted or misunderstood. You know, I notice that my words often get taken out of context because I'm one of those people. I'm very verbose. So it takes me like 3 or 4 tweets to say what one person can say in one tweet. And sometimes people will miss like 4 of my tweets, see the 5th one, and think I'm saying something completely different than what I'm actually saying. So I think that, you know, with artists, they can very easily be taken out of context. And also some artists are just jerks. You know, they're just not great human beings. And
sure.
And I'm not convinced that the world needs to really see that, you know, they're not great people. You know, they make great art, and that's their purpose. Their purpose isn't for us to dissect their personalities and say, oh, this person's a great humanitarian. Wow, this guy's a real jackass. You know, the point is they exist to entertain us, and we've taken it so far beyond entertainment, and we've given them so much power along with the fame that sometimes I feel like rappers are raising our kids because they've almost become role models, which is something they've really not signed on for and something they probably shouldn't sign on for.
That's a really interesting point about sort of the good, the bad, and the ugly. You know, you get to see all sides. I think that part of that is because, and, you know, Armand, you know, jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, because you deal with this from the artist perspective, but I feel that whether people are, how do I want to put this? I would say that people expect, even though they might know that artists are being a little sort of couched and coached on how they're supposed to talk on Twitter, people sort of expect nowadays that they get a bit more access, that they get a little bit more of that insight. Otherwise, why would they be following this artist on social media? They don't want to just get, you know, download links to the latest single or whatever.
None of us do. If it's too promotion-y, it tends to turn us all off.
Armand, if you're, hopefully you're there. How do you try to strike that balance?
You kind of have to treat Twitter and any sort of social media as that, just that, social. Behind anything that you say, there always needs to be some sort of purpose behind it and reasoning, as opposed to just, I want to connect with the people. Okay, well, connect in what way? As Wendy said earlier, do you like anything that you do, whether you agree or not? Because I hate that fact, but we have to just be honest that nowadays, you know, people aren't buying your album, they're buying you. So, you know, nowadays people aren't spending $10 on your album, but they'll spend $20 or $30 on a concert ticket because they want to experience you and almost say, because I've had this as an artist, you know, you're nothing like you were on Twitter, or, you know, I love your personality. I love this. You know, the music has almost become secondary. You're a great rapper. That's the door, as opposed to just being the end all be all as it once was. So with anything that you share, whether it's, you know, your kids, you know, your relationship, your girlfriend, whether you're even just live tweeting award shows or sports games or anything that's going on, anything socially or culturally that's going on, there needs to be some sort of purpose behind it. And it needs to be tied into your music and the persona that you want to show to the public. And if you're not doing that, you know, my son just distracted me. if you're not doing that, you could easily confuse the consumer. And they're like, well, hey, you know, you're this self-righteous person in your music, but then, you know, you get on Twitter and you're ignorant, you know, you get on Instagram and you're posting pictures of bottles, but then you're telling us, there's no hope with dope. So you just have to be careful with it.
So Wendy, I have a question for you. You know, you sort of touched a little bit about how, you know, what you said when you first got on, this idea of, because of partly due to the internet, that artists can do so much more on their own, right? Whether they get investors or whether they are, you know, well, I mean, they need some sort of money, but I always got the impression that, especially during the, what I would almost term the heyday of the major label, that there was sort of people who were there to, you know, on one hand they did like the, you know, styling for the photo and the video shoots, but also people there to sort of, you know, train them on how to do TV appearances or how to work with the media and stuff like that. And what can independent artists do if they don't, you know, if they're trying to do it on their own, they don't have access to that. I don't even know I doubt that sort of thing really exists on the level that it used to at the major labels. How does that work now?
It definitely doesn't. We haven't had artist development in so long that it's scary. And it's funny that you mentioned that because I'm one of those consultants that make sure that my artists are all media trained. The best thing an artist can do, or anyone who's going to go in front of the public, the best thing that you can do is just sit in your living room and have somebody speaking. It's the most eye-opening experience when that footage gets played back. I remember when I was being media trained, I had a tendency to rock back and forth because I was nervous. So when I watched the footage of my first interview, and thank God it wasn't public, it was being done in my living room, I looked like a crazy person. I sat there just rocking back and forth, and it looked terrible.
I think that's actually really interesting. Obviously I've had no media training or anything like that. I can tell you just from when we do, you know, so we're almost on episode 100 of this podcast, and we've done a couple of them live on, you know, using a Google Plus Hangout right to YouTube. And if I ever try to watch the footage back afterwards, I just sort of cringe. I think that's sort of a human nature. And I wonder if, you know, I wonder how many independent artists have actually thought about things like that. So aside from, not to give away all your secrets, but aside from that great advice to film yourself and watch it back, what else can, you know, people who are trying to, you know, who may not have had formal media training, what are some other sort of, I don't want to turn this into like a tips and tricks show, but what other sort of easy things would you recommend?
Definitely not smoking a blunt right before an interview. It makes you too calm. I'm not a smoker, so I don't have to worry about this, but most of my artists are. And most of my artists will smoke a blunt to take the edge off before the interview. And then when they're being interviewed, all of a sudden, the interview starts to sound like this, know what I'm saying? And then I did this, know what I'm saying? And then after that, I did this, know what I'm saying? And it's just like the excitement tone in the voice that's normally there kind of comes out because the artist gets a little too relaxed. For me, right before I do an interview, I always drink either a Diet Coke or a cup of coffee. I'm not really a coffee person. I'm more of a Diet Coke and an iced tea person because I want to make sure that I'm caffeinated for it. I want to make sure that I'm up so that when somebody's listening to my voice, especially in a radio interview or a podcast, my voice has some intonation in it and has some highs and lows and ups and downs so that, you know, people don't start snoring while I'm talking.
I will often record podcasts with a giant mug of tea next to me. It's right. You need a little bit of, you want a little bit of that. And, you know, you want it to be dynamic. You don't want it to be just sort of exactly what you said, droning on.
You just don't want it bland, you know?
So I have a question for you about, you know, because you do consulting, you do writing, You really have, as you said before, really your career has been about helping artists either avoid bad contracts altogether, sometimes help them negotiate the right contract. It seems from, you know, if you sort of look at where we're at in 2013 and if you sort of forget the history of music, it seems as though if you have a big enough of a regional following or maybe even a big enough of an online following, although I don't know how much that turns into sales just yet, but if you have a big enough of a following and if you have the ability to put music directly on iTunes, if you have the ability to sort of control your own destiny, why do you think it is that we still see up-and-coming artists really desiring and striving to get signed to a major label?
I think it's the fame that comes along with a major, because the one thing that a major does bring you that being independent can't is a larger awareness and a fame, meaning if I'm signed to my own label, I'm going to be able to make money and I'm going to be able to feed my family and I'm going to be able to make the music that I want. But when it comes to, you know, hosting the Grammys or even just making an appearance on the Grammys, it's not going to happen, because as an indie, you can't get a large enough fan base, of course, unless you're Macklemore, but you can't get a large enough fan base to bring you into mainstream primetime television. And if you're signed to like a Sony Records or Def Jam or whoever, they can get you that. You know, they can, if you're signed to Sony and Beyonce is going to do the Grammys, then they've got enough leverage where they can say, okay, not only will we give you Beyonce to perform, but we want you to take our newest act, so-and-so, who's also going to perform. And you've got a little bit more leverage as an artist to get into the doors that normally would be closed to you as a new artist. As an independent, you don't have that leverage. You don't have the ability to say, well, gee, if you take me, I think I can get you Beyonce too.
I'm glad you brought up Macklemore. Go ahead, Armand.
Let me play devil's advocate on that, because that is absolutely true. It's funny because when I was on the plane, I read an article that I think I got from your Twitter feed, Wendy. It's either them or a Scratchy Throat, because I love them. Oh, is that you? Is that you too?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So, Wendy, correct me if I'm wrong. There's WendyDay.com. There's SlavesNoMore.com. There's WendyDay.wordpress.com. And then there's a ScratchyThroat.net. Is that everything?
Yes, and if you go to WendyDay.com, it links to everything.
All right.
So you can just go to one place. You don't have to remember all of those different sites. But yes, they're all my blog sites. They all have different reasons for existence, and I'll break that down as we go further. I don't want Armand to lose his train of thought.
That's right. Sorry, Armand. Go ahead.
Okay. No, you're good. You're good. Now I know that I just can subscribe to WendyDay on my Flipboard.
There you go.
And get everything from there. So there was the instance of what Hoodie Allen did recently, where Hoodie basically used his leverage from his Twitter followers to get on Fallon. How do you feel? Like, do you think that that's, we're going to start to see more of that, where that's going to become the...
I hope so. I hope we see more of that, Armand, and I hope that he maxed that out, or his team maxed that out for him. I hope they got benefit from that other than just building his awareness. Like, I hope they were smart enough to drive the audience to his website or to his YouTube video page. You know, I hope they monetized it, is what I'm saying. When you're an artist and you're independent, sometimes you forget to monetize stuff because you get so excited about the opportunity that you forget that there's a reason for you doing that, whether it's to promote your new record, whether it's to drive somebody to your website to sell T-shirts, whether it's to drive them to your YouTube page so that they'll see a video, and then there's a link right there, right to your iTunes page, so that if they like the video, they can press buy and then they can download your single for 99 cents or $1.29, or your album, you know, for $10. Whatever your goal is, I hope that the independent artist remembers to do that.
So you had mentioned you mentioned Macklemore before, and he has talked often about being independent. But a little while ago, a little merged online because people were making the point that, well, sure, he's not signed to a major, but he has major distribution. Do you see?
Well, he has independent distribution through ADA, which is owned by Warner Brothers. But he doesn't really have major distribution. He's got indie distribution.
Okay, so I was going to say, so explain that, because I think most people see...
I'm so glad you brought that up. Like, that's so... You know, if there was a list of things that I would want to talk about, that would be right on the top of the list. Because I saw all that hubbub, too. And it was really heartbreaking to me, because it was almost taking away his success by saying, okay, yeah, he went 5 times platinum on his single, but he hired the same people that Warner Brothers hires to do radio. But you know what? We all do. You know, he hired the same radio team that I hire on all of the projects I consult. And yes, they're guys who work for major labels as well, but they're independent contractors who are available to anybody that has that kind of budget to spend. And the point is that somebody on Macklemore's team was savvy enough to know who to hire and how to police them so that they did a really wonderful job. And he ended up selling, 5 million copies. 80% of those were downloads, by the way, which is really high in terms of download sales of Thrift Shop, which to me is just really amazing. And then he has sold 1 million copies of the album, if I'm not mistaken, via iTunes and in stores. But he didn't go through Warner Brothers distribution. He went through ADA, which is an independent distributor that happens to be owned and operated by Warner. And what that means, when you have an independent distribution deal, it means they have access to all of the same stores that Warner Brothers does. They just tone it down a little bit, because as an independent, you don't have the multi-million dollar budget to be able to just ship your CDs everywhere. You know, if you're signed to Warner Brothers, they're going to make sure there's at least one copy of your CD in every store in America. You know, in the stores where they feel you'll sell more copies, they'll ship more, but your CD will be everywhere. When you're independent and you don't have a fan base yet in a certain region, you can bypass sending your CD to that region and just focus on the regions that you're working. And that's the beauty as an independent of having an independent distributor, because as you expand, your distribution expands with you. So that, let me give you an example. I'm based in Atlanta, and let's say I'm working with an artist who's also based in Atlanta. We're going to focus on the Southeast first, because that's home, that's our home territory. So if I'm only working in the Southeast, it doesn't make sense for me to have copies of my record in Oakland, California, just taking up space in a store, or in Phoenix, Arizona, just taking up space in a store. It's better to wait until we're ready to branch out to those areas to then put our records in stores, so that it doesn't look like we just sat there with no sales for 3 months or 6 months or 9 months or however long it takes. When I come into a territory, I want to be new and fresh. I don't want to be the record that just sat on the shelves for almost a year that nobody bought, because that mindset can be a little damaging when you're trying to work an artist who wants to be seen as brand new and with fresh product.
For everybody who's...
I explained that well.
You did, and I was going to say, for everybody who's listening, if you haven't, I believe on April 21st, I think that was the date, you had a really great article that you put up on distribution, sort of breaking down every step in the chain of how distribution works.
Thank you.
And you,
that's at industryreport.com. That's actually my personal blog.
Okay.
And that's where the bulk of the how to articles are for the music business.
I believe in there you make a comment that right now digital is about 50%, physical is about 50%.
It is about 50-50, 60-40, depending on the type of music you make.
I was going to say, and I think you mentioned the demographics can kind of skew it towards either younger goes a little more digital, older will go a little more physical.
Exactly. Also, the more pop it is, the more digital. The more street, the more traditional sales. So Yo Gotti is going to sell more CDs than Black Eyed Peas.
That's interesting. Yeah, you a higher percentage in football.
Exactly. Excuse me. Yes.
No. Hey, yeah, I'd love to see Yo Gotti sell more than Black Eyed Peas. You actually bring up Yo Gotti. You brought him up a couple times, talking about how he, I believe this is right, how he, the success that he can have doing the sort of not even small, more like medium sized towns doing shows and really being out there and touring.
He's done a great job at that. You know, I noticed him in 2003 when he was still independent, putting out records through Selecto Hits. And I think that was his second or third album, and he sold 125,000 copies. And back then, CDs were $17.99. So that's really kind of amazing when you think about, you know, that kind of revenue for a new artist. That's amazing. On an artist selling a $17.99 CD, he was probably making $12 for himself. You know, today on a $9.99 CD, the artist is making about $5 or $6. But he caught my eye because his grind is just incredible. He goes out on the road and he works markets, and he treats the smaller markets like Lafayette, Louisiana, like they're huge markets like Chicago, Illinois. And I love that about him, because a lot of artists sort of half-ass it when it comes to the smaller markets, because they just feel that they're not as important because there's less people there to support them or to buy their music, and that's just not true. You know, you can have a huge fan base in the South, in the smaller cities, that will far surpass anything you can do, like in Atlanta, Georgia, or in Houston, Texas, even with the amount of people there. So I love that he does that, and that's why I use him. I use him a lot as an example, and I use Tech N9ne a lot as an example for indie. You know, I was talking to Tech's partner last week, Travis. And he told me that Tech N9ne makes $70,000 a month just off of his YouTube television account. And to me, that's amazing that an artist can monetize their videos so well that they can bring in that kind of income just on their YouTube pages.
That's the sort of thing that makes, you know, obviously he's probably, at least among independent artists, almost certainly an outlier in terms of bringing that in. But just the fact that that capability exists. You know, I mean, Armand talked about a little bit earlier how, you know, I think he was sort of getting to the point that fans are, you know, sometimes in it for the whole artist experience. And sometimes the music, I don't want to say becomes secondary, but it just becomes one piece and sort of, you know, on a similar relationship. It could be, you know, I think it's already becoming some of this way with how concert, you know, how the money that an artist can bring in from touring compared to an artist from CDs. But I think, you know, if you can monetize things like YouTube, that even, you know, all of a sudden that's a whole new outlet for an artist, right? You know, maybe they're recording music to try to drive people to a YouTube channel, which, you know, 10 years ago would have seemed like the most absurd thing in the world to me. But, you know, that's incredible.
It's incredible, right?
It's incredible.
It's just unfathomable, you know, and even a newer artist who's maybe doing 5% of that, you know, even that's a gift. You know, the fact that you can make a living doing what you love just by making music and you know, selling your movement to people is just, it's just amazing to me.
The comment you made about, you know, Yo Gotti and the medium sized shows, I live in Connecticut, and I see that even up here in the Northeast, where, you know, despite the fact that maybe New York hip hop hasn't sold as much as, or at least been as culturally dominant as it was when I was growing up, there is still definitely a tri-state sort, and really a Northeast there. That is a, that can be really a single region. And there are certain artists who can do very well. And when artists do tours, I see that it's the same thing all the time. They do a bunch of shows in New York. If they do come up here, they go to New Haven, they go to Providence, but it's really just because they're trying to get to Boston. Then they turn around and come home. And they forget that there's cities in Connecticut alone, you know, cities that have 100,000 plus people, Hartford, Waterbury, you know, you can go up in the, into some bigger cities outside of Boston and Mass. These are all cities that have, you know, not just some of them. I mean, Hartford has arenas, but like also, you know, sort of that medium size, exactly what you're describing
for
Yo Gotti.
Look at Springfield, Massachusetts. That's a great market. And most artists miss it completely.
Totally.
They don't get it.
One artist who I will give credit, even though I'll admit, and we've talked about it on the show, I'm maybe not the biggest fan of his music, but if anybody works Connecticut in the North and really Massachusetts right now, it's French Montana of all people. French Montana, he goes to Waterbury, he goes to Springfield, he goes to Danbury, he goes to Stanford. Like, he goes to all these medium-sized markets.
I would have never guessed it.
Part of it is because his DJ, Big Mike, is from Connecticut. I think that's part of it. But just in general, they do all these club dates, you know, Meriden, Connecticut, even smaller like club dates. They do all those club dates. So as a result of that, you know, he's able to go. I mean, obviously, you know, when you're doing those, I'm guessing when you do those medium sized club dates, you probably don't want to hit a bunch of medium sized cities within like 20 miles of one another. But, you know, he can sort of loop around and come back around again. And it's been amazingly effective for him.
It's also really effective for building a career, because when you're able to reach and touch your fans, you know, it's like politics, where you really want to be able to shake hands and kiss babies, you know, and when you're able to do that in multiple markets, that's what people remember. They remember that connection to you, and that's so key. I'm both amazed and impressed that he's doing that. I think that's awesome.
So a little bit before, you were talking, when we were talking about Macklemore, and you were talking about how, you know, he hires the same people you do when it comes to doing radio promotions. Can you explain a little bit how that works? You've done this in your writings probably last month or so. I've read some of your articles that I think do a really good job at this, but I think people have a lot of misconceptions about how radio works. And if they assume that you're spending any money at all towards radio promotions, they just think payola, and then they just sort of tune it out. That's not really how it works,
right,
though.
Not. And I am going to explain it, but we don't have enough time for me to really break it down. So I'm going to refer people, before I explain it, I'm going to refer people to industryreport.com because I've got three articles on there about radio play. And the most important one, I think, is actually called the most important article I've ever written on radio play. And it really is, but it's like a mini book. So having said that, you don't even want to go for radio play until you've got legs on your record, until your record is really buzzing and bubbling in your marketplace. And in your marketplace, I don't mean just your city, I mean your region. So if I lived in Connecticut, I would want my record to be bubbling in Connecticut, in Massachusetts, in New York, outside of New York City. You know, I wouldn't focus on New York City first. I would focus on the outer line areas like Albany, New York, you know, the just outside of the city,
sure,
Syracuse, et cetera. I would be working the streets, meaning I'd be working the colleges, the clubs, the malls, the flea markets, the high schools. Any place where there's a large amount of my potential fans where they gather. And I would get my song to the point where people on the streets were starting to know it and like it and sing along to it. And then once it had legs, then I would start approaching radio. And I've been doing this 21 years. I never even approach radio myself. I always hire professionals. Because you want somebody that, A, does this for a living, and B, really knows what they're doing. Because this is an area where you can lose a lot of money. And when I go after radio, if I have an urban record, I start in the urban radio sphere. And you can spend anywhere from $20,000 regionally up to $80,000 nationally to break a record at radio, you know, at urban radio. If your record is more rhythmic, and rhythmic is like what Rihanna is, what Lil Wayne is, it's a little closer to pop, but it still has an urban edge. With rhythmic radio, you can spend anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 going after radio. And then with pop, which is like what Justin Bieber is, or Britney Spears, or Black Eyed Peas, you know, that's the more mainstream music that exists. You can spend $250,000, up to $250,000 going after pop radio. So you've really got to make sure that you've got a budget in place to do what you're trying to do. And you want to make sure that you've got some professional people, because the last thing you want to do is spend $250,000 and lose the money. You know, you've got to be really careful about what you're doing. And radio is just an area where you can lose your money pretty quickly. But you want to get it buzzing on the streets as strongly as possible. And then from that point, then you want to start to approach radio in a regional, orderly fashion. Back up your record by putting your artist in those marketplaces, either on a promotional tour or on a, if you can get your artist on, you know, a mainstream artist tour, that would be a beautiful thing. You want to be able to get your artist into the marketplace so they can do interviews at the radio station, and so that they can tie their shows into the radio stations. They can do giveaways. You know, for example, if I'm an artist and I'm in Connecticut, you know, I might do a back to school giveaway depending on the time of year that it is. And that may consist of some book covers, some pencils, and my CD. You know, it's a little something to give away at radio to have the fans call in and try to win. You know, we'll give this to the ninth caller.
Sure, sure.
It's a way to tie radio into the artist on a marketing promotion level instead of just spinning the record. So there's a lot of different things you want to do. Radio depends upon, you know, the cost changes based on the time of year that you go after radio. The cheapest time of year is in the first quarter, because that's the least competitive. The most expensive time of year is usually the fourth quarter, because that's when the heavyweights come out. That's when, you know, the M&Ms and the 50 cents usually drop. So radio really depends on what your competition is, who else is in the marketplace. There's a lot of things that you need to really watch when you're chasing radio with your artist. But I'll say this for radio, you know, I do know that traditional radio is dying, but it's dying a slow death. It still is the most effective way for us to reach a large amount of listeners at one time. And the last thing that I'll say about radio is, if you're going to chase it, please make sure you have a radio record. Make sure it's mixed and mastered properly. Make sure it's the same quality as a Jay-Z record or a Kanye record, because that's where you're entering the national stage. That's where you're coming in and you're saying, look at me as an artist. I am the same as Rihanna. I'm the same as Jay-Z. I'm the same as Kanye. So your sound really has to be the equivalent in terms of quality as their sounds are. It's got to be mixed beautifully. It's got to be mastered by a professional. It's got to sound really, really, really clean and good.
Yeah, I mean, and you talked a little bit about this, I think it's the exact same blog post that you mentioned when you first started. And this sort of sums up what you said before, but it really sounds like the biggest thing that you need to worry about is you're not going to use radio to drive demand, right? You sort of have to get the demand first, and then radio hopefully kind of, not this is a bad pun, but amplifies it, right? Radio will take it and then hopefully launch you to an even bigger thing.
It's your tipping point. Exactly.
I'm glad I took notes, because I got tons of questions for you. Hopefully this is all right. You had another great blog post on April 11th talking about the things that artists do that don't necessarily lead to success, right? Things that artists shouldn't do. And I'm being polite about that. One of the things you think artists should do, and I thought this was really interesting, especially considering, you know, we just talked a little bit about radio and we talked about some of the things earlier, is the idea that if you have a hot single, you should promote it for 3 or 4 months, not weeks, not 3 or 4 right. tweets, not, you know, right. 3 or 4 months.
Right.
You
if
never
it's really
see
a hot
that.
Single and you know that it's a hit because you tested it with 20 different DJs and they all told you it's a hit record. I would suggest even working it for longer. I've worked singles for 9 months before they caught on. In fact, the best example I can give you of a major label doing this was Nelly's first record, took 9 months to catch on. You know, they knew it was a hit, so they didn't give up on it. And it's a really good thing they didn't. It was Country Grammar. And it's a really good thing they didn't give up on it because that spawned his entire career once that song caught on.
Yeah, Armand was in St. Louis then, weren't you, Armand?
I wasn't in St. Louis, but you know, I'm from St. Louis, so I always you know, that's one thing that I miss about radio and just culture in general is pre-internet was like, you know, I'm a military brat, go to different cities. You know, we would go to St. Louis, we made sure that we had a pack of cassettes because we knew that what they were going to be playing on St. Louis radio wasn't at all what was going to be playing in California. And there were going to be artists that we had no idea about. You go to St. Louis and you'd hear about, you know, we heard about Nelly and the St. Lunatics long before Country Grammar. So, you know, people knew that they were on the verge. So when they blew, it wasn't really a surprise to St. Louis and the region, because as you and Wendy have said, they worked that record for so long. And even not only just Country Grammar, but I mean, E.I., Ride With Me, the singles that they had, the region already knew about them. So this was just introducing them to the world.
Yeah. Exactly. So Wendy, would you say that artists have is it a lack of patience when it comes to their songs, or is it just they don't even know any better?
And this has always existed, at least the 21 years I've been doing this. Artists are inside their own heads. And here's what I mean by that. They go into the studio and they make a record, or they make a bunch of records. In their heads, they know which records were easy and which records were hard. And to them, the records that were hard are the ones that have more value, because somewhere in life we're taught that we have to struggle to make something good. We can't just go in the studio, make a song within 30 minutes, come out, and it becomes a platinum best-selling hit record. But that's usually what happens. It's usually the records that are the easiest, the most simple, the most catchy. They're usually the ones that catch fire. But for some reason, artists who live in their own heads aren't willing to let that happen. So they tend to work the records that they spent weeks and months and they couldn't get this verse just right, so they rewrote it and rewrote it and relayed it and relayed it in the studio until they got it just right, and then it became the perfect song. The problem is that perfect song sounds very labored. That's the first problem I think artists have. And then the second problem is, and this is still in the same vein of they live in their own heads, they'll make a song in January. So by March, it's old to them. And they want to do new stuff because there's something about music, it has to be new and fresh. So by March, they're already tired of it, and they've already lived with it for 2 months, and it just sounds terribly old and dated, because they've now grown and they've gone on to doing whatever the next thing is that they're doing, you know, in their artistic career. And then along comes somebody like myself or yourself, and we hear a song that they did a while ago, and we go, oh my God, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And their reaction is, oh my God, that's old. That's not great. It's old. But it's a hit record. And they don't realize that new does not necessarily mean great. New just means new. And it's very hard for artists to get out of that mindset where new is better because it's newer. And that's what I mean by artists living their own heads. Instead of allowing the DJs, or if they're signed to a record label, allowing the record label to dictate what's really marketing-wise viable for their careers. Because sometimes when you're not living in that person's head, you can dictate a little better what's hot and what's not, because you didn't struggle to make it. You don't know how old it is. You don't know if you made it last night or if you made it 6 years ago. You just know that it's a great record and it has commercial viability. And I think sometimes that's what happens with artists. They work a record and then it feels old to them and they're tired of it. So they then go and put out the next record, but only 4 to 6 weeks have passed. So they haven't really given the first record a chance to bubble and catch on before they start working the next one. And then they'll do that with the next one and the next one and the next one. And, you know, that's what Cash Money was doing when I met them. They were putting out records every 6 weeks. They were putting out a new artist. So nobody got worked longer than 6 weeks. And it takes longer than 6 weeks to really start to bubble and grow and reach a fan base large enough to become successful with a song or with an album.
So I'm pretty sure, Wendy, that you have been completely eavesdropping on every Skype conversation Armand and I have had over the past 6 months. Armand's been working on an album. I produce, you know, I've done a bunch of production. I've mixed most of the album, or a chunk of the album. I've mastered most of the album. We have been, everything that Wendy's saying is exactly true. There are records on Armand's upcoming album that I have far too much of an emotional attachment to, because I sat here belaboring over, you know,
exactly,
over everything. Whereas there's one particular record that we did in like maybe 30 minutes and I haven't really touched
it.
Armand, you got anything? I'm sure you got something you want to say about that, Armand.
And that's the record that, you know, I've slowly started to, you know, I equate it to when celebrities sell their photos to the magazine. I've slowly let people start to, you know, see the baby and touch it and play with it. And, you know, the early feedback is that those records that I worked like hard on, they were like, yeah, those are okay. Like that's all you get. It's okay. It's a good record. It was all right. But the records that were just snap of a finger, just in the moment. And that's kind of what I try to do. I kind of try to emulate my work ethic similar to a Pac and a Jay, just kind of take their mantra, as opposed to like music being a feeling and you kind of want to capture that moment in the bottle, because I think that resonates with the listeners. And those are the records on the album that people are saying, yeah, that's incredible. Well, you just don't overthink it, because I think you can overthink it and you can, you know, make the scientific, lyrical, schmerical Pythagorean theorem records that people don't want to think about records. They want to feel records. You know, we attach music to emotion and my kids keep distracting me.
It's all right, man.
But that's the reality of the music business, you know, and that doesn't mean that if you make a record in 30 seconds that it's automatically a hit either. You know, I certainly don't want to go too far in the other direction, but it's just, fans can tell when something is fun and light, and they can tell when you've labored meticulously over something. And sometimes light and airy wins, because we all live really difficult, convoluted lives, you know? And the whole point of music is it's an escape, you know? It's entertainment. It's not supposed to be heavy and overbearing. You know, it's supposed to be fun and, you know, let's go out to the club and dance tonight. Let's, you know, let's get rid of some of this stress, you know, or music is background music when you're doing something else. You know, when you're working, you want something playing in the background. You certainly don't want something that's going to change your mood and feels very aggressive and oppressive when you're trying to do something else. So, you know, sometimes the lighter, fun stuff really stands out.
All right. So I know Armand has to get out of here relatively quickly, and we don't want to take up too much of Wendy's time. So Wendy, there was one last thing I wanted to ask you about. We've talked about a bunch of the ways that sort of music has evolved. And one thing we haven't really talked about is streaming. So when you talked about distribution, you know, digital is about 50%, physical is about 50%. You talked a little bit about how someone like Tech Nine can monetize YouTube, but I'm curious as to where, you know, if you have any sort of thoughts on where, how you see streaming impacting, you know, how music gets distributed, right?
Yeah, I think that's where it's going. You know, I think the future are the Spotify's of the world. I think streaming is, you know, if you can have access to every song that exists for $10 a month, I think you're going to do it. I think that's right. A far better deal than 99 cents per song. You know, I think music is like movies, is like cable TV. I think we want access. We want to hear it whenever we want to hear it, and we want to have access to it immediately. But we don't care whether we own it or whether we rent it. And I think that streaming is definitely the direction that it's going. I think streaming is very popular now. Right now, though, we're having a little bit of a tug of war between the streaming companies and the content companies. Mm. We haven't quite worked out who gets paid what yet. So you're seeing a lot of infighting amongst artists with Spotify. You see a lot of independent artists especially complaining because they get paid less than the majors do. You know, surprise, surprise, the majors have people fighting for their rights. They've got lawyers and MBAs, you know, in there fighting constantly for their rights, where the indies do not, per se. So the indies are paid less. But I think once we work out that content gets paid what, and we will, it will get worked out. Because if it doesn't, people will just continue to steal music. And by steal, I mean download it for free without paying for it. It's too easy to do that, and it's too accessible. So until we find a way to give people what they want at a price point that they're willing to pay, I think that we're not gonna eradicate the theft of music. So fortunately, the good thing about that theft of music is that it makes the content creators a little bit more realistic in what they ask for, and a little bit more down to earth in what they're willing to accept in terms of payment. So once we work that out and that tug of war becomes more fair and equitable, I think we'll be fine. And then I think we'll figure out, you know, which streaming company is really the best. There's a couple of them that are just starting up. I know iTunes has just thrown their hat in the ring. They're trying to get into it. Daisy is coming, which is, you know, the Beats by Dre company. Spotify's already, you know, the number one streamer, I believe. It's either them or Pandora in terms of memberships. So I think that that's definitely the way that we're going to receive music, but I think we're a good 3 to 5 years away from that. I think it's coming, but it's not here yet. We're still buying music.
Yeah, we're big fans of Spotify over here on Clock Radio Speakers. My biggest complaint, and I'm definitely a Spotify premium subscriber. My biggest complaint is that Spotify, it seems to be trying to replicate the iTunes experience, right? Basically, if it's available in iTunes, you can assume it's available in Spotify. And where that sort of doesn't work for a lot of music is that, so that means, you know, if you have all these artists releasing music on mixtapes, that doesn't get there. If you know, now artists are really embracing SoundCloud. You know, the sort of the electronic dance music movement, right? EDM or dubstep, house, whatever you want to call it. Tons of those DJs, all their stuff is only on SoundCloud. My only problem with Spotify is that it's not really like a totally complete picture, but
yeah, it's not inclusive enough, is it?
No, I feel like it's still, you know, for something that's all digital, it's still, you know, because Armand and I have obviously done a little bit of, you know, we've done a lot of research to figure out who do we want to go with to make sure his album is up on these streaming sites. It's still a lot of work. Like it's still, they really want you to go through, if you're not in a major, they want you to go through somebody like TuneCore or CD Baby, or they want you to go through somebody else. Like, you'd think it would be maybe not as easy as SoundCloud, where, hey, log in with Facebook and upload a track, but you'd think there's got to be some other way to do this.
You would think, right?
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that that's coming. I'm hoping that that's going to all get fixed, you know, as technology grows and as bands dictate what they want and how they want to receive it. I'm kind of hoping they're going to fix that. Also, some of my friends who are a little bit more active in the social sphere than I am, they complain that I guess Spotify is not social enough, whatever that means.
That's interesting.
And I've heard a lot of people complain about a difficulty in searching for new music, meaning they have a curation problem as well. I seem to be able to find the stuff that I want, so I don't really have too much of a problem. I don't find new music on Spotify. I find it elsewhere and then add it to my playlist. So it has never been a problem for me, but there's enough people out there complaining about it that they're going to address that at some point.
It's interesting you brought up social, because just relatively recently, Spotify has made a big push. Now you can finally follow people on Spotify. Spotify has been heavily tied in with using Facebook as a login since they got it. But that's interesting, the curation problem. Spotify, it's funny, there are certain artists where you go to look for their stuff and you're like, why isn't that there? But then there's other things where, you know, you'll find just the most random stuff. Like, I found complete like CD singles from the late 90s, including the instrumental and the acapella. Right,
wow.
which is just random, almost like somebody like was sitting there, like, you know, ripping and uploading, you know, manually. But then you can't find, you know, certain artist stuff. So I agree with you that
even as far as spelling stuff, so it'll be, you know, instead of and they'll have Hall and Oates, so they'll have Hall and sign Oates, and then they'll have Hall and Oates. And there'll be a totally different collection of their music. It's crazy.
Oh, that's bizarre. Yeah, that's bizarre.
I hope these are growing pains, though, right? Because, I mean, like, you know...
I'm guessing, because it's still very new, isn't it, considering?
It is. We sort of forget that. But, you know, 5-6 years ago, whenever I went to music conferences, people thought that, you know, ringtones were going to save the music industry, right? Everybody had MySpace.
I remember that.
Everybody had MySpace addresses and, you know... Things move relatively quickly, and Spotify has really only been in the U.S. for what, 2 years, 3 years tops. So I hope that it continues to evolve. And frankly, I still think some people, I mean, you mentioned iTunes is rumored to be getting in. I imagine Google's going to want in at some point. Like, there's still some chips to fall.
I agree. And the thing about iTunes is they've already got the relationship in terms of content, because they sell the music. So if they do set up iRadio, which is supposed to be like a Spotify, I'm guessing that they will probably, because they dominate the market now, I'm guessing they will probably dominate the market there as well. Time will tell.
I imagine that's got to scare the labels a little bit, right? Because if they feel...
I guess so, because you don't ever want somebody to have that much power. Then they become like Walmart, don't they? Where they start dictating price.
Not even that, but, you know, if iTunes is the predominant digital retailer, right? And I feel like the labels, the attitude I hear is that they tolerate streaming, but they really want you to buy, right? And if Apple goes from promoting downloads to promoting streaming, that's a, you know, that might be an opportunity for somebody like Amazon or whoever to pick up more of the actual MP3 downloads, but that's not something I don't think the labels are really ready for.
I agree.
Hey, I've got a question.
Okay.
I've got a question. Just because we've kind of talked about that Spotify is something that, or just streaming is where we're going, and it's obviously not perfect. So since the crux of the conversation has been in the realm of independent artists, do you recommend, Wendy, and even Doc jump in, that an artist puts their project on Spotify now?
Oh, yeah. Is that strong enough for you? yes, because when you're an independent artist, the most important thing to you is exposure. you want to be able to expose yourself, and I don't mean that in any bizarre way, but you want to be able to expose yourself to as many new listeners, because your income stream is more than just that 99-cent download. If somebody discovers you on Spotify, even though they're not buying your music, they may come to your concert. They may spend $50 to get into your show. They may then spend another $125 on merchandise at your merch table. It's so much more than a 99-cent download. And, you know, if I have to give away 99 cents to make $50 or to make $125, I will do it every day. I think awareness is so key for an independent. So when I hear indie say, oh, I'm not giving away my song for free, I'm not putting my stuff on Spotify because I only make 0.6% of a song, you know, it shocks me that somebody would say, you know what, I don't want my music out there. Isn't the point of being an artist to get your music out there? And if it's becoming all about the money, I think it's important to monetize. And I think you got that from hearing me for this past hour. But if it becomes all about the money, I think there's just other ways to make better money.
Mm. And I've got one last question, since you kind of mentioned touring. And Wendy, I just retweeted an article where Kid Rock is making his tickets, what it was, like $12?
$20. Mm-hmm. Isn't that awesome?
That's incredible.
It is.
Like, even so, is this just general admission? So this is floor seats. This is everything.
I don't think it's general admission. I think he's selling all of his tickets for $20, and I think that they're assigned seats. He's reacting to the fact that when you're a large star, they take a large percentage of your tickets and they sell them to scalpers automatically. And they do this because the scalpers will then turn around and sell your tickets for huge amounts of money. It becomes very profitable for the scalper. It becomes very profitable for the promoter because the promoter gets a big kickback. It becomes profitable for the artist because they get a big kickback from the scalpers. And it's just, it's pricing music out of everyday people's realm. You know, so that if you and I decide to go to a Rolling Stones concert, aside from the fact that everybody I know will think I bumped my head, we'll end up spending somewhere between $200 and $500 for that evening. And there's a point where it just becomes too much money. So what he negotiated with all of the venues, he negotiated with the promoters, and they decided on a flat fee for the ticket. It includes parking. Then he negotiated the price that he will charge for his T-shirts down to, I want to say $24, but don't quote me on that. I can't exactly remember the price. But instead of spending $35 or $40 on a T-shirt, you'll end up spending about half that price. And you'll be able to get a beer for $4 once you're inside the show. So if you're somebody who goes to a show and enjoys drinking beer, that will also be discounted. So what he's doing is he's saying, enough on these $500 nights to come see me. Now if you want to come see Kid Rock, you're going to be able to do it for you and a date for under $100, way under $100. You might even be able to get dinner and the show for $100. And what it's done is it's sold out his shows all over the country within hours or days of the tickets going on sale. And that's especially amazing because he's not considered a current, you know, top-selling artist. You know, so that's kind of amazing that he can sell out faster than the Rolling Stones can. And it's because he heard his fans complaining about the pricing and said, okay, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to take a pay cut, but at least I'm going to have a career in touring for the rest of my life because I'm willing to take less money now. And just keep out on the road. And that's what he's doing. I think it's amazing.
It's almost a little bit like what Louis C.K. has done with his comedy tours. I went to go see Louis in Hartford last fall, And the tickets were a little bit more expensive than $20, but they were, you know, they weren't that that much. But it was just right to him. You know, he didn't do anything with Ticketmaster. There were no like service charge or fees. It was at good sized venues, but ones that maybe you wouldn't traditionally get for someone like Louis C.K. And you know, it was simple. There was no scalping allowed. Like, you just paid your money, you got your ticket. It was.
I love that.
Yeah, it was.
I got to tell you, the last time I went to see Chris Rock, I think I paid over $100 for the ticket.
Yeah.
So I would love to pay $20 to see Chris Rock. I love him. You know, if it were that cheap, I'd go every time he came to town.
I know. You know, the ticket prices. I mean, I'm going to see D'Angelo in Boston at the House of Blues at the end of this month, and I'm lucky enough that that's a general admission show, and tickets are $50, but hey, it's D'Angelo, right? I mean, when am I going to see D'Angelo? You know, but yeah, $20, that's unbelievable.
It's kind of amazing that he's doing this. I hope more artists do it. I'm watching it very closely, because if, God forbid, something goes wrong, that's going to end it. You know what I mean? Like, if one thing goes wrong, that's going to be the thing that all the scalpers and the ticket companies and Live Nation and Ticketmaster hold up and see, we told you it wouldn't work.
Mm.
So I'm watching it very closely, and I'm really encouraged.
All right, Wendy. Well, I know Armand's got to go, and I'm sure you do too. So I, you know, on behalf of Armand and the rest of our audience, I want to thank you for coming on this week's show. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me. And if you need to reach out to me, you know, hit up wendyday.com, links to all of my other websites. So you can go to my blog from there. You can go to Slaves No More from there. You can see my book there. Everything that I do is at wendyday.com.
And people can follow you on Twitter at Rap Coalition.
Absolutely. And actually talk to me. My God, like, I actually talk back. It's really cool.
Yeah, you do actually. It's always, no, it is, you know, because I'm trying to do a little research before shows, and, you know, I was watching you and, you know, sort of go back and forth with somebody, and I thought to myself, that's what Twitter's supposed to be, right? It's like, all right, you know, let me promote this blog post I wrote, or let me promote this thing that I do. But when someone has a comment, you know, assuming they're not being spammy or they're not really trying to be derogatory, but assuming they have a real comment and assuming that it's not an overwhelming volume, engage them, right?
Absolutely. It's been really helpful to me, because every now and again, I'll ask people, you know, what do you want me to write about? And I just wrote an article for Producers that was born out of the fact that I probably got over 100 tweets asking me to write about the current state of, you know, production and beat making. And it never crossed my mind that they needed articles.
Oh, we do.
So it kind of opened my eyes to it. And I said, oh my God, let me go write something for them.
Oh my goodness. I used to do the beat shopping thing in New York much more often before I had a traditional 9-to-5 job. And oh my goodness. I mean, everything you said in the article, it rang so true. The prices have dropped even lower, which is, you know, discouraging for someone who's coming up.
Very discouraging. But that's a topic for another interview.
It is. And that, you know, frankly, my experience, you know, shopping beats in New York and doing, you know, beat battles and conferences and all that, that's what, I mean, you know, Armand and I were friends before, but that's why I'm glad that I can work with someone who, you know, I have a stake in his music, right? I mean, it's a partner, you know, it's somewhat of a partnership, right? It's not just I'm selling him some beats and I don't know who he is, right? I'd rather make music that way.
Exactly. It's a collaboration.
That's right.
And I think we just made a really good point for another conversation. I think the unanimous vote we get back is we're going to have Wendy back on the show at a later date. Just kind of,
I'm happy to do it, and I've got to really give you guys props, because I know you don't make money doing this. I know that this is a labor of love. I know how much passion it takes, and I love that you keep it up, because there has to be a point where you're sitting there saying, "Gee, I could be with my family right now," or "I could be at work right now," and you don't. You do this. And I love you for this, because I know how hard it is. I know how frustrating it can be, but it's so needed and so necessary, and I just love that you're doing it. So anything you guys ever need, please don't hesitate. Pick up the phone, call me, tweet me, send up a smoke signal, whatever. I'm happy to help you any way that I can.
Well, thank you so much, Wendy. We really appreciate that. So, everybody, thank you so much for listening in, and we'll catch you all next week.